Thanks. I appreciate this opportunity to speak before you. I wish I could tell you that I was excited about it. I wish I could tell you that I deeply anticipated it. I thought that I was on probably one of the best weight loss and sleep deprivation programs around. I call that the Pastor April Make Me Nervous program. But as you probably heard in first service, I was wearing my jacket, and I actually probably lost twice as much weight just standing up here sweating like a dog. And so I really do appreciate the opportunity, and one of the reasons is that my wife, Cheryl, and I have been going to this church for about 4 years, and at the church I used to go to in Atlanta, Georgia, for probably about 20 years, there was a group of people that just instilled their vision for what they wanted for the church, and they instilled it in my heart. You know what I'm saying? They didn't just put it in my mind, they instilled it in my heart. And I wish I could tell you that I went willingly. I did not. Like great young parents that my wife and I were, we took our children to Sunday school every Sunday morning, and then we went to IHOP and had breakfast. And really enjoyed not going to church, because that eating time without our children was probably about the only time we had to just not do anything. I used to joke about how old I was going to be before I actually could read the entire Sunday paper. And I don't know if those who have young children, you know what I'm talking about. You just give up sooner or later. And we were kind of like that. But I was lucky. I was very fortunate, because there were people at the church that I was attending who weren't going to have it, if you know what I mean. So they continued to place it on our heart that that was not the thing we needed to be doing. We needed to be at adult Sunday school class ourselves. And we were like, yeah, yeah, you know, the guy with the black and white shoes and the really ugly jacket. You know, there's one at every church sometimes, but this was the guy. But he instilled that in my heart, and at first I was cynical, and I kind of thought it was going to be a waste of time, and I wasn't really interested. And next thing I know, I was teaching Bible study 5 Sundays out of the month, and my wife was teaching children and running the children's center, and everything was just kind of going. And so when April came to me and asked me to speak while she was gone, I felt like it would almost be a dishonor to those people who placed that vision in my heart not to share with you the gift that they gave me through basically adult Bible study or Sunday school class on Sundays. And for those of you who don't know, there's a very vigorous group that meets over there at 9 o'clock. And now they are doing a Bible study every Sunday. And it's the same Bible study that Methodists are doing all over America. Well, that's not completely true, because I go to some of those Methodist churches, and usually when I say I'm there for the Bible study, I mean when I'm there for Sunday school, they ask me how old my children are. So one of the problems that my generation's created is we've kind of driven Bible study into the background in church. And why is that? Well, because I know what you're thinking, man, Bible study, it's boring, it's not relevant. And the best reason? Well, I don't know anything about the Bible, so why would I want to go to a Bible study when everybody will know? Well, I'm going to tell you a little secret about Methodists. None of us know anything about the Bible. And when I started teaching the Bible, I didn't even know who John Wesley was. Once again, it's not surprising. A lot of Methodists don't know who John Wesley was. And if you don't know, ask me after and I'll tell you who he is. But these people didn't just con me into being a teacher. What they did was they nourished me. They corrected me. They straightened me out. They told me what I was doing right and what I was doing wrong. And sometimes they hurt my feelings, but that said more about me than it did about them, because what they were interested in was something that was very important to them. And so today's story that I'm going to talk about is about my latest hero, is a guy named Nehemiah. And I just discovered him last quarter. I've been teaching Bible study for a long time, and I'd heard his name. I knew he was in there, you know. He's near Psalms, right before Esther, you know, but Nehemiah is just another one of the ayahs, you know, Jeremiah, Nehemiah, Hezekiah. Didn't really feel. And the thing about Nehemiah is he wasn't a prophet. He wasn't a king. He wasn't famous, really. He was, and he wasn't a religious leader. He was a cupbearer. Are you guys paying attention? You know what that is? Big gulp, right? So what had happened was he had placed on his heart that he wanted to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. They had been torn down for 150 years. And he just placed on his heart. How did he get placed on his heart? Well, you know, we believe as believers it was the Holy Spirit. But It just was something, I mean, you know what it's like when you get something placed on your heart. You try to put it aside, and it kind of keeps nagging at you and keeps nagging at you. If you have a vision for this church, if you have a vision for your life at home, if you have a vision for your career, most of us do all of that. If you're on any of the working committees of the church, you probably have a list of things that are visions, which sometimes are just wishful thinking and hopes. But there's a lot of things. Everything that ever gets done because someone had a vision. And that's one of the truths. If you don't get anything else out of this, you need to get this truth about vision. They never come from outside. You can't import vision. You can't hire someone to come in and give you a vision. Vision comes from inside. And inside, you want the bad news? You know what inside is? Inside you. That's where vision comes from. And so Nehemiah was one of those guys that he had a vision to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. He had never been there. He had no dog in that fight. It was the home of his ancestors. And in the scriptures he says it's where his ancestors were buried. He'd never been there. He was in a foreign country. He had a pretty good job. It was menial. But, he had a roof over his head. He didn't really have any reason. So he goes to the king, and I was talking to kids about names. So we have a king named Artaxerxes in today's lesson. And it doesn't matter, he was a Persian king. And so what happens when Nehemiah has this placed on his heart to go rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, and he's in Babylon, and he goes, this is on page 374 if you want to follow along, chapter 2. It says, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when the wine was served him, I carried the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had never been sad in his presence before. So the king said to me, why is your face sad since you are not sick? This can only be sadness of the heart. Then I was very much afraid, and I said to the king, may the king live forever. But why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my ancestors' graves, lies waste, and the gates have been destroyed by fire? And then the king said to me, what do you request? So I said to the king, if it pleases the king and your servant has found favor with you, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my ancestors' grave, so that I may rebuild it. It's pretty bold. The king said to me, and the queen was also with him, how long will you be gone, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a date. And then I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, so that they may grant me safe passage. And also may I have a letter from Aspa, the keeper of the king's forest, directing him to give me timber to make beams for the gates and the temple fortress, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I asked, for the gracious hand of God was upon me. Now I know what you're thinking. Have you ever gone into a boss or a committee or anything and made a proposal and said, hey, I want to build an addition onto the church, or I want to shoot something mild, I want to expand the capabilities of my little office or my cubicle? And the boss said, well, sure. How long are you going to be gone, and how much money do you need? Yeah, it doesn't usually happen. And I don't think it happened in Nehemiah's case either. It's not like just because he asked, the king gave it to him. So, for example, Nehemiah was a cupbearer. How did he know he needed timber? How did he know it wasn't there? How did he know he needed safe passage to get there? How did he know these things? What do you think? He went and asked somebody. When a vision gets placed on your heart, or when something gets placed on your heart, you can't just stay at home and pray on it. Now, it says Nehemiah prayed, and I want you to understand, the first step in good planning is prayer. That's the first step. But that's not the only step. And I know one of the criticisms we get as a church sometimes when people come to us with requests, we say, well, we'll pray on it. And usually that's where it ends. When Nehemiah praying was the first step, and every step he took, but it wasn't the final step. It was the first step. So what did he have to do? He had to plan. He had to go out and make a plan. He had to ask people, hey, what's it going to take to rebuild this wall? First of all, they probably said, well, you're crazy. You're never going to get it done. You're going to get killed on the way there, and when you get there, nobody's going to help you. They're poor. They got nothing. They're disgraced. The rubble, you can't build it. The rocks are all crumbling. All that sort of thing. But he developed a plan. And then he kind of waited. He didn't say he walked into the king and demanded an audience. The king could tell there was something wrong with him. For those of you who are married, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I walk in sometimes, my wife says, what'd you do? She just looks at me. Okay, how bad is it? What's it going to cost? But these are things that people know. So the king asked him. And the key to Nehemiah was he was prepared when the opportunity presented itself. He had already done his homework. Gave the king a plan, and it blew him away. The king wasn't a Jew. He didn't care about He didn't care about rebuilding the city. So then Nehemiah gets to Jerusalem. So does he go riding in on a big parade? Okay, I'm here to save the day. I'm going to rebuild the walls and everything's going to be fine. No, he doesn't do that. He kind of stays below the radar, and he spends 3 days going around and surveying the city at night to see just how bad it is. Because he's told these people, or he's kind of committed to God, that he's going to rebuild this wall, but he really doesn't know what he's in for. So he figures, when I get here, before I tell anybody about it, I better figure out what I've got. So he goes out and he surveys it, and he probably writes some stuff down, and he figures it all out. He doesn't let anybody get in his way. And then he pulls all the people together when he's finally got a plan. Not before, when he knows what he's going to do. And he says to them, you know, it was placed on my heart to come rebuild these walls. But let me tell you why you should do it. You should do it because you need to protect your children. You need to protect your daughters. You need to protect your wives. You need to protect your land. And quite frankly, you're a motley bunch. You need to kind of get yourselves together. And I think building something is a great way to do that. Great sense of accomplishment. And this is one of my favorite verses in this whole lesson is what it says the people did. It said the people committed themselves to the common good. And one of the things I thought about was, man, I would just love it so much when my wife came home from a finance committee meeting or trustees meeting or any kind of committee meeting at the church. And I said, hey, how was the meeting? And she says, man, we committed ourselves to the common good. You ever been able to come home from a meeting at church and been able to say that? Maybe once. It's not typical. But this is indicative of Nehemiah, who's a cupbearer. This guy has no skill. He's not an orator or anything like that. But he was able to get a downtrodden group of people who didn't think they could do anything to get them to basically decide to do something. Not because he was some great, you know, prophet that was going to bring them all this stuff. Did it because it was for the common good. It's amazing how much common sense stuff there is in the Bible. You know, there's a bumper sticker that used to be out. It said, you know, the Bible says it, I believe it, and that settles it. And that's why people like Jesse Ventura say Christians are narrow, are simple-minded. Because the truth is, the Bible's full of true stuff. But it's in the Bible because it's true. It's not true because it's in the Bible. And this is, Nehemiah is a poster boy for how to run a business. How to get something done. I think they should teach Nehemiah. We talk about prayer in school. They should teach Nehemiah in business school. Because this guy did it the right way. And he didn't do it because he went to Harvard. And he didn't do it because he went to Stanford. He did it because something was placed on his heart and he was determined to do it. And he did it the right way. So what happens? He's got his stuff. He goes to the people, they agree to the common good, so what? He's got a well-oiled wall-building machine. Just sit back and keep the schedule. You're a little behind today. Is that what happens? No, it's never what happens. What happens almost immediately when you start a great project, especially if it means a lot to you? First thing that happens, opposition. Trust me, there's always somebody that's going to be opposed to what you're doing. Somebody in city council, somebody on the building committee. Typically, it's the finance committee, and you know why they're opposed to it, because they don't know where they're going to get the money from. So you know what I'm saying? You've got to get opposition. And he got opposition. And let's see what happened when Sanballat and Tobias, who were the local leaders, when they found out. We're going to read a little bit from chapter 4. This is very typical of what happens. It says, now when Sanballat heard that they were rebuilding the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he mocked the Jews. He said in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore things? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish it in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burn ones at that? And Tobiah, the Ammonite, who was beside him, said, and by the way, Tobiah was a Jew, he said, that stone wall they are building, any fox going on top of it will break it down. So, what happens is and the little story I told earlier, when the Wright brothers were trying to fly their plane at Kitty Hawk, everybody stood around and said, man, that thing will never get off the ground. And then when it lifted off, everybody said, that thing will never land. I mean, that's the way people are. It's our nature to just basically be opposed to things that are not our vision but someone else's. So Nehemiah definitely had that kind of opposition. So what did he do? They said, we're scared to go out there and work. This guy, Sanballat and Tobiah, they're going to come and they're going to kill us when we're out there working. So what he did was, and it says in the scripture, they worked with one hand and they held their swords in the other hand. And it's really amazing because when the opposition saw that they were not going to be deterred, they kind of said, oh, what are we going to do now? And they kind of backed off. So then what I call the real opposition came. You guys know what the real opposition is to a project or a vision or anything that you have? What's the real opposition? It's the people that you think are behind you. It's called the hidden, the inside. And I always, what I like to say is what inside opposition is, it appears, it's like a wolf in sheep's clothing, the three D's. They distract you, they discredit you, and they deceive you. And this happened to Nehemiah. Or, if you want the reality TV version, you got intrigue, innuendo, and intimidation. And that's basically the MO. That's what people do. That's what I would do if I wanted to discourage you from doing something. First, I would distract you. I'd give you all these things and all these other things to do. Discredit you. What they did to Nehemiah was, oh, you're in here. You're trying to make yourself king. We're going to tell Artaxerxes on you. Boy, then we'll know. So there's this self-aggrandizement. But the deception was really important, and I want to talk about that. Because what they told him was, you know how people do, they come to you and say, hey, look, Nehemiah, there's people that are out to get you. And they're going to kill you. So what you need to do is lock yourself in the temple, and we'll stand outside and protect you. And Nehemiah immediately knew that this was something he was not going to do. One reason why was because going into the temple was illegal for him. And that's one of the things I want to say, that if there's ever something that you're doing with the church or with your own life, and the execution of your vision requires you to do something that's against God's laws, then it's not from God, and it should be put aside. And that's what Nehemiah knew. He was a cupbearer. He didn't know whether these guys were telling the truth or not, but he knew something was up because they were asking him to do something that wasn't right. So he didn't do it. Well, the other thing he did was he responded to the people. They said, hey, we can't take care of our own land. We're in poverty. We have all these things going on. So he went to the leaders and he said, you know what? You guys really shouldn't be charging interest. It's against the laws of Moses. And he got them to give back. He says, and you can't let people sell their children into slavery. And he literally stood up for the people that were doing the work and to the leaders and said, you can't do this. And they agreed. So it's not like you can be totally tunnel vision on what you're doing. You have to kind of step back, let things be reevaluated and re-looked at, kind of modify what you're doing. But you can't get distracted from what's going on because all of these things are designed to distract you. We were joking the other day, so the number one distraction in the church is committee meetings. It's like in the Congress, man. You know when you ever hear, that bill went to committee? What's that code for? That bill is not going to see the light of day. And I don't think church is any different. Distractions, discourage, all these types of things. And so these are the things that leaders like Nehemiah responded to. And what do you think happened? Built the wall to half height, restored all of the gates, 52 days. I don't know if you've ever seen some of these pictures that are going up behind me. That's the kind of wall. 52 days. Got it built. So that's, to me, is a great example of how someone who theoretically has no skills, no background, has nothing but something on his heart, gets something done. So what can we learn? I already said the one thing. I think it's very important, is that vision has to come from within. And if you look at all the things that this church does, almost all of them started with a single person's vision. The other thing is, and this is the hard part for me to tell you, but I'm going to tell you anyway, you have to pray like everything depends on God, but you got to work like everything depends on you. And I know as church people, we're real good about the first. I am. I'm real good about, I'll pray for you. Man, don't ask me to work. I got too much to do. I'm busy. I'm tired. I'm sweating. Whew, man. So, but the truth is you got to pray like everything depends on God. But if you want to get anything done, you got to work like it depends on you. The other thing is, people that work for God are more likely to worship than people who worship God only are likely to work. So just think about it. I'll write it down if you want me to. But you know what I'm saying. I'm kind of saying coming to church is the beginning. It's not the end. This 20 minutes that you are listening to me flap my jaws or whatever, this is designed to put us together in a body, but there's plenty of people here that have vision. Attach yourself to somebody else's vision. Support them. So in conclusion, let's look at how we kind of can pull this together on a day-to-day basis. And by the way, this is not just true for the church. This is true for our family lives or our personal lives. The first thing we should think about is whatever here is seize the vision. Mark will put it up. And that is that the success of vision rest on the willingness of people to examine the vision's potential. So you got to seize it, you got to make it your own, and you got to put it out there. Because people have to embrace it. What Nehemiah did was he went to the people and he says, man, don't do this for me. Do it for yourselves. Do it for your family. Do it because of something like that. Number two, clarify the vision. And this is where it's really tough because you got to get help here. How do you clarify a vision when you don't even know how to build a wall? So basically that means put it in a form that the people who will be called upon to accomplish it. Remember, when you have a vision, other people are going to have to accomplish it. You saw that with our kids here. If you want to build a wall, you're going to rely on people to do it for you. You can't do it yourself. So you have to clarify it so that they can understand it. Number three is test the vision. Test it. Take it to the committees. Run it up the flag. Let everybody look at it and examine it. I guarantee you there'll be plenty of people to point out everything that's wrong. Not many people will tell you what's right, but there's plenty of people will tell you what's wrong. That's a good thing, by the way. You don't have to pay attention to everything they're doing, but you need to give them that opportunity. One of the reasons is you'll figure out how your project is being perceived. And then you can modify and do some things, do something about it. Number four is form the vision. Reduce it to clear and concise. That's really hard, especially for somebody like me, to be very succinct about what it is your vision is and how you want to do it. Outline the steps for its completion. What's it going to take? Nehemiah did that to the king. Sold. And I kind of say what that can mean, too. Sometimes make a drawing. Write it down. Put it, simplify it so people can see it. Number five, share the vision. This is something we're usually pretty good at. If we have a vision for the church, go tell everybody. Don't just tell the people on the committee. Don't just tell the people you know. Tell everybody. Let everybody know. Because everybody is who's going to be part of what's going to happen. And they're much more likely to accept responsibility for its completion if they're part of it, as opposed to, oh yeah, I heard about that. And finally, this last one is incarnate the vision. That means bring it down to earth. Keep it alive. Actually, when I thought about that, I really couldn't figure out what they meant, but I really liked the way it sounds kind of churchy, doesn't it? Incarnate the vision. So just fill in the blank, whatever you want there. I know it means something really profound, but the more I thought about it, I really couldn't figure out exactly what that was. So there are the steps, and now we come to the hard part, or the harder part, and I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, well, I know some visionaries at this church, and shoot, I might even have, that I can get behind them, and I might even have some visions for myself. But if you're not sure you got enough time, or if anybody will help you, that's another reason. Well, I'd have done it, but I didn't think anybody was going to help me. Remember what we've talked about today. There's more to it than just having the vision. Nehemiah is a good example for us to be prepared when the opportunity presents itself, to ask people, to get what you need. And now let's go to our faithful God in prayer. Oh God, the source of all that is good, we give you thanks for the blessings of life and the opportunities to serve you. We confess, however, that sometimes we become discouraged and dissatisfied. The path often seems long and difficult. Renew our strength and give us the courage of our convictions. We come to you humbly as we pray the prayer that you taught your disciples. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory.